Court is ready to hear argument in 030913, Kroger Texas Limited Partnership and Robert Moody versus Teresa Subaru.
May I please report, Ms. Subaru will present argument on the to make a citizen liable to be mulcted in damages.
What does mulcted mean?
Mulcted means, you know, I kind of like to think of it as mulch. You're just piled under in it. For an honest discharge of duty is to give immunity to crime and to weaken the restraining power of criminal law, thereby endangering the security of law-abiding people. For this reason, Texas law gives defendants, malicious prosecution defendants, an initial presumption that they acted in good faith. Now more than ever, in light of heightened security concerns in our country, citizens need to know that they can report crime without fear of compensatory and punitive damages when they're merely expressing what they believe. The Court of Appeals in the Digby case got this right. That court recognized that the presumption affords no more protection to a malicious prosecution defendant than any other defendant if a plaintiff is able to come and rebut it with just her own testimony and nothing more. You would never have a presumption of good faith if you allow a plaintiff's self-serving statements to rebut it every time.
Well, why couldn't the trial judge charge the jury that there's a presumption? It's not just a level playing field, pick one side, but there's a presumption, and then also allow the uncorroborated testimony you're complaining about. Wouldn't that still preserve the presumption?
Kroger did actually request a presumption instruction, and the Texas law, I believe, is that whenever a trial court instructs the jury about a presumption, that's an impermissible comment on the weight of the evidence. For that reason, the court has held that the presumption is merely a matter of going forward with some evidence, and once the presumption is met, then the presumption disappears. My guess is that by feeling that the presumption was met or rebutted, the trial court felt the presumption no longer was in play and hence had no role in the trial. The other states that have considered this point agree with the El Paso Court of Appeals that a plaintiff's self-serving testimony without more is insufficient. In this case, I think it's especially notable that Ms. Subaru's testimony not only was uncorroborated, but also was self-contradictory. She claims that Kroger must have known that she didn't have a cart because she never saw the cart. But in her own criminal testimony, she admitted that she saw the cart and that Kroger pushed the very cart that she now claims she didn't see back into the store. There is no evidence in this case, other than plaintiff's own statement that she didn't do it, that Kroger didn't have probable cause. Probable cause focuses on the subjective awareness of the complainant. All of the evidence that plaintiff presented merely goes to the reasonableness of it, but there's nothing as to the subjective awareness that's required for malice. If the inquiry for probable cause is somewhat objective in that it does look at what would incite a reasonable person to believe committed a crime, but then in order to actually establish liability, the person has to actually believe or have a very strong suspicion that the person did not commit a crime.
What do you think has to be corroborated? The amount of time she was in the store, or the fact that there was a card or not a card, or there were groceries in the card or not in the card, or the Hertz payment, or to what extent do you think corroboration is required if that should be the rule?
I believe that corroboration should be on a material fact that affects the complainant's belief as to whether a crime was committed. For example, in this case, if Ms. Subaru had a disinterested witness come in and say, I was standing right there, and she wasn't even near a cart. She never touched a cart. That's corroboration.
See, that's going to be kind of hard to come up with, because at least if you presume innocence in these things, or even if you presume guilt, usually the person who is detained is not looking around for witnesses at the moment that they're being detained. They're worried about what's going to happen to me next. So you're not trying to get names and addresses so that you can call them later and say, remember that card I had. So it strikes me that this could be a very heavy burden for a plaintiff to discharge.
I think that it can be. I think you're exactly right, Justice Peck. The reason that that's justified is when you look behind the reason for the presumption, just like with the presumption of innocence, we recognize that the prosecutor may not be able to overcome this presumption and people who are actually guilty may get off. But the underlying policy justifies what I'll call that fiction in some instances to protect certain important societal interests. In this case, it may well be that if there is an occasional case where a plaintiff who has a legitimate malicious prosecution complaint is unable to prove her case. But I think the other side of the equation and the benefit and the need to encourage citizens to report crime outweighs that nominal risk of not being able to prove a case.
But do you think in this case, just to take a particular, if she could prove that she was only in the store 10 minutes, that would pretty much corroborate her story, wouldn't it?
I think that would be enough to rebut.
She did have $216 worth of groceries in 10 minutes if she was standing over at the pharmacy for two of them.
I agree with you. That would be enough to rebut the presumption, and then it would simply be a matter of her proving her preponderance of the evidence burden that Kroger lacked probable cause. The important thing that's missing in this case is there is no corroboration of any kind about how long she was in the store, whether or not she had a card. In fact, her own testimony is conflicting on this issue.
Well, what about the argument that you waived this point because it was never expressed in terms of requiring corroboration? It was always a general no evidence point. Because perhaps if it had been articulated, I mean, I agree that generically that might be considered subsumed under a no evidence point, but if you had articulated it as no corroboration, the case might have been tried differently. She might have tried harder to find that kind of corroborative evidence.
The objection that Kroger made was to the legal sufficiency and in particular the lack of evidence of subjective awareness that she was not committing a crime. The fact that we did not cite the Digby case is not dispositive of this issue.
But aren't those two different things, evidence of subjective awareness and specifically corroboration?
Not necessarily. The corroboration is simply a sufficiency of the evidence argument. It's more support for the argument that it requires more than what plaintiff put on. I don't think any trial counsel is fully prepared to make full appellate arguments at the trial court level. At that point, you're preserving error and moving on. Judge Calvert has expressed that all you need to do to preserve evidence is to state you have a legal sufficiency objection, and we did that. The Arcoma case, which also is before you, has similar issues. And if the court were to find a waiver in this instance, I think it would very much inhibit litigants from being able to fully develop their cases on appeal when they have properly preserved.
It would also allow defendants to lie behind the log and not, you know, I mean, admittedly, if that specific objection had been made, the plaintiff might have attempted to put on other or additional evidence.
Actually, I don't think so, because when Kroger was arguing that the presumption had not been rebutted, the judge, Judge Canales, stated that he believed it has because there was some evidence Kroger did not, that she didn't have a card, and therefore Kroger gave false information. And because the judge was convinced that no matter what, that was sufficient evidence to raise a fact issue, it would not have made any difference in the trial court.
Can we explore the procurement for just a moment?
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't it true that if we take your argument to its logical conclusion, the DA always has the discretion. A citizen can't force a prosecution to go forward. So are there limits to your argument that there has to be proof that the complainant somehow had the ability to make the prosecution happen? It's always in the prosecutor's discretion, isn't it?
I think to some extent, or mostly it is to the prosecutor's discretion. I think the key issue is what the prosecutor testifies was the determining factor in his decision. In order for the complainant to be the cause of the prosecution, the information that they provide, the false information they provide, has to be the determining factor. This case is an interesting foray into what false information is sufficient to show causation. Plaintiff argues that Kroger said it stopped her in the parking lot instead of the foyer. Even if that's true, that's not material to the crime and not material to a prosecutor's decision whether to prosecute. The police testified it's immaterial where they're stopped so long as they pass the point of purchase. So I do think there are cases, in fact, there are many cases, I think, where a prosecutor would say, if but for that information, I would not have prosecuted, but this is not the type of case we have here. In addition,
so your sadistic corroboration rule it's not limited to shopkeepers, it's everybody.
I don't think the court needs to reach that in this case. For purposes of this case and the important societal interests underlying malicious prosecution, I think the corroboration need only be for purposes of rebutting the presumption of good faith. There is case law to support, back from the late 1800s and early 1900s from this court, that where you do have an interested witness whose testimony is uncorroborated, that in the face of contradictory testimony is legally insufficient evidence. It doesn't appear to me that Texas law has followed that course, although it has not expressly been overruled, but we would submit in this case the court need only limit its decision to the presumption of good faith and rebutting that presumption, because that preserves and promotes the underlying
You tell us there's two states, Mississippi and North Dakota, that have done this. I assume that means that the rest have not?
From the research that we conducted, the only states that we found, we actually found a few additional states that we cited in our reply brief.
Okay.
Alabama has three decisions, all of which are cited in the reply brief. And the Lindsay versus Camelot Music case was actually attached as an appendix exhibit. Alabama has held.
So
that
Mississippi, Alabama, and North Dakota.
And Delaware and New York. The North Dakota case, the plaintiff pointed out in his reply that it could be read either way. Kroger agreed. So we would submit that the only clear cases, the states involving clear cases, are New York, Mississippi, Delaware, and Alabama. And in each of those, it involved similar facts in that the plaintiff's general denial of guilt and proclamation of innocence was the sole evidence that the plaintiff was able to come forth with in order to establish lack of probable cause. I will reserve my remaining time for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Mr. Thomas Coward will present argument for the respondent.
Can you please the court? Tom Coward for Teresa Severa. Your Honors, despite appearances, this is really not a malicious prosecution case at this point. What it actually involves, as y'all raised, is straightforward appellate procedure issues, presentation of complaints issues, and just the generally applicable rules that govern appeals in Texas. The rules that you should apply here are well settled, routinely applied by the appellate courts, and serve important judicial and policy considerations or goals. Virtually every issue presented here by Kroger that relate to the malicious prosecution liability are burdened by fatal procedural problems. I guess the bottom line, the mantra that I might be repeating over and over again here, Your Honor, is that there are certain rules that apply in Texas appellate courts, and no matter whose ox is getting gored. And at this point in time, Your Honors, Kroger's ox is getting gored by these rules. Starting first with the cooperation issue, I attached their efforts to preserve their no evidence complaints as appendixes to our brief on the merits. And if you look through those, Your Honors, you'll see that nowhere in there do they mention the word cooperate. In fact, I can't find it in the record at all. They cite Digby over and over and over again in their pleadings, but nowhere do they say that Digby applies in this way. If you will, judges, I think essentially what they're asking you to do, Your Honors, is create a Malooey JNOV, or motion for directed verdict. Remember, the Malooey Brothers case says that when you're appealing from a summary judgment motion, your point of error is properly the trial court error in granting summary judgment. And under that point of error, you're entitled to raise any and every complaint you have about the summary judgment that's properly preserved below in your brief. And so what they're saying here, Your Honors, is that, well, we should have a similar rule for preserving no evidence complaints in the trial court. We should be able to say to the honorable judge of this court, the plaintiff's evidence is legally insufficient, respectfully submitted defendants. And from that, I'm entitled to complain about any and every problem that I can find in the record once I get up on appeal. That's not the way the system works, Judge. The often cited explanation for when the evidence is insufficient is Justice Calvert's law review. And he says that among the times when the evidence is legally insufficient is when there's a complete absence of evidence on a material fact. And another one is when the rules of law or evidence prevent the court from considering the only evidence offered to prove a vital fact. I would say, judges, that on the one hand, when you go in and say there is no evidence of subjective intent or no evidence of malice, what you're really saying in that instance is there's a complete absence of evidence to support that material fact. If, on the other hand, you're going to argue that the rules prevent you or the law prevents the court from considering the only evidence offered to prove a vital fact is in Justice Calvert's formulation, that ought to be specifically argued to the trial court.
We stop a customer outside the grocery store with a pack of cigarettes and no receipt. Many people like me throw our receipts away immediately or don't pick them up at all. They say, I did pay for it, I paid cash, I just don't have the receipts. All of those cases go to the jury, and the jury can find malicious prosecution or not. That's all you need is the plaintiff in the malicious prosecution to say, I did too pay for it.
Judge, I think that the Ritchie case specifically says, no, that's not the case. Ritchie and, I don't know how to say it, the Leike case, those cases say that if the objective elements, and I think Martin says that as well, the case from this court 2 months ago, that if the objective elements of the crime reasonably appear, then
the argument would be as it is in this case that they weren't reasonably appeared because they knew that I paid, even though the store employees all swear they don't know it. If the plaintiff says they do too, the manager was standing right there when I paid.
I think that Richie says
the jury could believe him, right?
The jury could, Your Honor.
And so Richie was wrong. Has to be wrong.
No, sir, because in that instance, the defendant can't say, or the plaintiff cannot say, that they didn't know that I paid, I don't think. I mean, I hear what you're saying in the sense of that it might be a fact issue that they try to create, but Ritchie says that if the objective elements appear, you don't get to go to the jury.
Well, I mean, here the defendant said the objective element, she had a cart, she's outside the store, didn't pay for it. Why isn't that the objective element?
Ritchie says that I guess in Ritchie the facts weren't contested, and that's the distinction. Here the facts are contested.
So all you do is you have to say they did too know because they were standing right there. I didn't steal, I paid for it.
And that might
don't be have a receipt, nobody else agrees with me, give me $100,000.
That might be the result of the way our system works, Judge. 2 weeks ago in the Dillard's Department Store versus Silva wrongful arrest case, This court specifically said when you've got a fact issue like that, when it's a credibility contest, who's telling the truth, then the juries make those decisions. And that's not an unheard of comment in our malicious prosecution law. You got Aiken versus Dahl from 1983 says the same thing. Ritchie versus Brookshire says the same thing. It's a credibility contest. And I apologize, Judge, you're right. I got to thinking about the wrong case. Ritchie says that in that case there, the facts were uncontested. The plaintiff said, yeah, I put the cigarettes in my pocket. Yes, I walked outside. Yes, I forgot to pay for them. I'm sorry, I didn't intend to steal them. And the court says, well, you can't expect them to understand your subjective intent. So in that case, the plaintiff admitted that he had committed the objective elements of the offense. It's kind of similar to Martin, because in Martin, the defendant or the plaintiff couldn't contest the fact that he had sold the cows, even though the collateralization agreement prohibited from selling any of the cows. But that's the way our system works. If it's a credibility case, under the Dillard's department store case, under Ritchie, under Aiken versus Dahl, those all go to the jury. But more importantly,
beyond your waiver argument, which I understand, we want people to report crime, and we don't want them to be so fearful that they will say, well, I better not say anything because that could be a bad result. So we want, of course, we don't want to tilt it too far, but we want to move it a little bit in the direction of favoring the reporting of crime so that people will be more encouraged to do that than if they just know they're exposed to liability. How do you, given that that's the case, as we've said, then why isn't a rule requiring corroboration consistent with and not too much bigger than that policy?
Your Honor, because it's unheard of in Texas case law. I mean, the only instances when they point to corroboration are statutory. They're asking to create a common law rule.
No, I mean, we have it in different areas. Service of citation. If they say they served you, you can't just come in and say they didn't serve you. You have to corroborate the fact that you weren't served, because we don't presume that process servers have a reason to lie about this. Now, we would similarly, we don't normally presume that shopkeepers have an advantage. It gives them more customers by arresting customers ever so often. The idea is that they're not going to do this to harass their customers because they want people to come there, and they will only do it if they really think it didn't happen. I mean, the crime happened. So there are several areas in law where we require corroboration, and the question is, should this be one?
Your Honor, respectfully, process service, you can defeat that by your own testimony. That's what the corroboration is. You go in there and testify that, no, I didn't get it. You show the process that's usually in your firm for receiving legal notices, and you demonstrate that that process was followed and it didn't wind up on your desk. On the issue, though, of it is a radical change in Texas law if you adopt a corroboration requirement. It's a departure from all the law that's gone before it. The Meadows case from 1975, Ellis versus Kiever from 1994, both those cases, this court considered whether it would increase the burden of proof on the malicious prosecution plaintiff. And the court said, no, the burden of proof is preponderance of the evidence and is reviewed under the traditional standards of appellate review. Now, preponderance of the evidence is not you've got to bring in somebody else to testify to support you. And secondly, Judge, it makes the most vulnerable person more vulnerable, the lonely stranger, the solitary person of a different ethnicity or a different race or from a different state, a traveler, somebody who has no friends in the area, can be a victim to whatever indiscretion or whatever the store owner wants to inflict on them. I agree that we would like to presume that everybody in the country and everybody in the state acts reasonably and for good purposes at all times. That's simply not the case.
Do you think it reflects on Ms. Subaru's credibility that the presence of any Hertz money out in the car can't be substantiated?
Well, no. Judge, yeah.
She has no records. Hertz has no records.
Of course, it reflects on her credibility.
All right, then let me ask you this. Hypothetical, she'd been walking out of the store, and Ms. Weir came up to her and said, where are you going? And she said, I'm going out to the car to get $30 that Hertz gave me an hour ago. And her husband, who was standing there beside her, and he turned around to her and just blurted out, "We don't have $30 in the car." Then if Ms. Weir says, "Okay, you know, that's enough for me. I think you're leaving here with stuff you have to pay for," would that give Ms. Weir reasonable probability to think that she was committing a crime? Just the fact that she knew at that time, or she had reason to know, that her stated motive for going to the car was not true.
Your Honor, I think in that instance she would have, assuming in your scenario that Ms. Segura is pushing a grocery basket full of groceries out the car, out the front door.
Well, that's it.
Then, that's an objective indication of an offense, and it doesn't matter why she's going out there.
Well, I suppose that the reason that the Court of Appeals doesn't want to consider whether there was any Hertz money out in the car is that that's not evidence that supports the verdict. That's evidence that's contrary to the verdict. And that's, of course, a rule to disregard evidence that's contrary to the verdict. But if that's really true, it does sort of put the case in a different light, that she's saying she's going out to the car for a reason that just it can't be substantial.
Your Honor, if I may, it's not true on this record. The jury determined it's not true. That's what we have jurors.
Well, the jury can't imagine that there's money out there when there's no money out there. I mean, that.
But if it's a fact issue of whether there was money out there or not, the jury, by its verdict, will resolve the fact issue in favor of Ms. Segura.
Well, she says that's what she was going out there for. There's no record. Nobody has any records that there's any money out there.
She says it's out there, Your Honor. And on the issue of other state law, if I can very quickly, when y'all look at these cases, the only state that says that cooperation is required is Alabama. And I don't even think that really says cooperation is required. What it says is bare denials of guilt are not sufficient to carry a plaintiff's burden of proof of producing substantial evidence resisting a summary judgment motion under Alabama procedure. We don't have a substantial evidence rule in Texas. I don't know exactly what that means. If you look at all these other cases, the Mississippi case, we've got a debate about it between the parties as to what that case actually means. That's in our briefing. You'll be able to read that. The New York case, there was an indictment handed down. And under the restatement and under New York law, if you've got an indictment, you've got to show, in order to defeat the claim of probable cause, you've got to show that the indictment was procured by false representations or by some bad means. You've got this indictment. So New York is not a case where you've got an arrest. It's a grand jury indictment. The restatement says that if you've got an indictment, that's some evidence that that they had probable cause. And then you've got to undercut the indictment by independent evidence. So that case isn't applicable here. The Delaware case that they cite, it's an instance where the plaintiff did not plead lack of probable cause. It's a 12B6 motion or a summary judgment motion under federal law. They did not plead a lack of probable cause, and trial court says, well, there's no pleading and no evidence to support the pleading. There's a mere allegation that these cops created these claims to hide their misdeeds in arresting the plaintiff. And this is a plaintiff who'd been arrested. He had been arrested. He conceded he'd been DWI. He conceded he was speeding. He conceded he was swearing at the cops. The contest in that case is over whether the cops beat him up in the course of arresting him. The North Dakota case, they've conceded doesn't apply. So when you look at these cases, there's only Alabama remotely, in my mind, suggests that this is a requirement. Secondly, if you look at Digby itself, which is the case that they're relying on in Texas, in terms of what it required for cooperation, in Digby it was a situation where a couple got a bank loan collateralizing some insurance policies. And they say that the vice president of the bank, who authorized this loan, who they did business with, authorized them to borrow against the value of these insurance policies to make payments against the loan. And then when they defaulted on the loan, the bank goes to collect on the insurance policies, and guess what? There's no value in the insurance policies. The Court of Appeals says, well, the only evidence that affirmative evidence that the plaintiffs advanced is their own testimony that there was this agreement with this one bank vice president that they were entitled or they were allowed to withdraw the value of the insurance, borrow against the value of the insurance policies. We're going to want cooperation. So what we find is corroborating evidence is the fact that the vice president didn't notify the insurance company. Or, more to the point, there's no evidence that the vice president notified the insurance company, so those insurance policies have been collateralized. That's not, to my mind, corroboration of material fact. In fact, it's corroboration with no evidence. How can you corroborate something under this case with no evidence of the fact? And that's what they're saying. Is that the lack of evidence of something corroborates the plaintiff's testimony that they have learned. If you're going to accept the Digby formulation, the hurdle the plaintiff has to get over to cooperate should be extraordinarily low. The Digby court says it only has to be consistent with the plaintiff's testimony. Well, that's what we've got here. If I've got to show cooperation that's consistent with my testimony, I've got statements in the evidence attributed to the pharmacy technician who was on duty that night, who knew Ms. Subaru by sight, who knew her husband by sight, who said that when she came in to the pharmacy, she didn't see a cart. She later says, oh, but I heard one. But you know what? That's contrary to the verdict, so I don't think you consider it. She says, I didn't see one. She was at my desk for a little while. She asked for her prescription, but I wanted to give her husband's prescription. She said, I'm going to go back out to the car. That might not be exactly right, Your Honor. As soon as I said it, I thought, wait a minute. I don't know that she said that Ms. Rivera said she's going to the car, but she did leave the pharmacy counter. And within a matter of minutes, she saw her returning to the store escorted by the Kroger employees who arrested her. So the time frame is cooperated. The purpose of going to the Kroger store is cooperated. The fact that she was surprised by being given the prescription for her husband is cooperated. The fact that she left...
So why did the Kroger employees do this? They don't like black customers.
Your Honor, I'm not...
That's what the only implication I can get.
Right, and I hear you, Judge. Kroger inserted race into this case. We didn't. They repeatedly questioned the witnesses about race.
What is their motive? Why did they do this to Ms. Subaru?
I'm not sure, Judge. I'm really not sure. Maybe they were looking to score. Maybe they get credit for arrest. Maybe they're NA. There's somebody.
Well, you're just speculating now.
I am, Your Honor, but that's what you're asking me to do.
We have to show malice. And if we can't imagine why a store would do this, why would that be malice?
Malice and motive are not equivalent. Malice is acting with conscience, with disregard for the rights of another person, knowing that you're likely to inflict harm on this person. And if it's true that they didn't see Ms. Severo pushing a cart out the store, they might have seen somebody pushing a cart out the store. My only theory is...
Yeah, but if they're just mistaken, that's not enough.
Yeah, but they weren't just mistaken, Jack. They knew, according to the jury, they knew that Ms. Severo was not pushing that basket. I think what happened... If I'm allowed to speculate, there's some people stealing the grocery cart or baskets. Ms. Subaru is mixed in with them as they're going out the door. Ms. Weir yells, stop. The people who are stealing skedaddle. Ms. Subaru turns around and says, yes. And they say, you're with them, which is in the record. You're coming with me. And so it's a matter of not merely mistaken, because they could see who was pushing what. But they figured that, hey, it's kind of a collect them all up and prosecute them all. And so it's not a mere mistake. It's they did not see her with that basket.
They thought she was part of a gang.
And then they contended that she was pushing the basket. And so that strengthens her case. They're lying intentionally to try to convict this woman who has nothing to do with what was going on. But Judge, there's some of that that's supported by the record, but a lot of that is speculation. But the record says she was going out. There was a couple of people in front of her that when they were called, when Kelly Ware called stop, she stopped. The other people didn't. And Ms. Subaru says, I didn't have anything to do with any basket. Your Honor, said, malicious prosecution does have a very fine balancing act. This court has said over and over again that the balancing act is accomplished by carefully defining the elements and then requiring the proof under usual and traditional standards to meet those elements. It's not accomplished by skewing the fight in the trial court so badly that the plaintiff cannot win. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I'd like to go back and respond to Justice O'Neill, a question you asked about the waiver argument. One reason Kroger contends there was no waiver is unlike an evidentiary ruling that the trial court could cure. There's nothing to cure here. This is a pure matter of law that can be handled at any level among the case without judicial waste such as you would have in the case of having to send the whole case back to be tried.
But it can be cured by the plaintiff. Plaintiff, if they hear your directed verdict motion that, you know, there's no corroboration here, they can ask to open the evidence to put on the witness they didn't think was necessary when they didn't think corroboration was required.
I think it's safe to presume that a plaintiff is going to put on everything she has in order to support her case. Certainly, there has been no allegation that she was precluded from putting on any argument or evidence as a result of the timing in which Kroeber cited this case. I'd also like to address Justice Brister's concerns about the malice. The problem in this case is there is no evidence of malice. The only evidence that was used was this lack of probable cause based on plaintiff's testimony, and that was used to infer malice. The problem is when you infer malice in that regard, it's a fiction. You're actually inferring a wrongful intent because you can think of no other reason that somebody would do something unreasonable. But as Justice Brister was pointing out, there is no motive here for Kroeber to turn away its customers. This only hurts Kroeber's business. And in addition, nowhere in the record is there any evidence that any Kroeber witnesses, and keep in mind, there were four people who saw her do this, one of whom was no longer employed at the time that he testified and was not in any way involved in the prosecution or even reporting of the crime, a completely disinterested witness. There is no reason why any of them would do this, and there's no evidence to support that they knew they were false or mistaken. The possibility exists, maybe they were mistaken, but there's no evidence that any of those witnesses thought they were mistaken at the time, and hence there's no subjective awareness of any risk. Also, this court's recent decision in the Dillard versus Silva case shows that being arrested is not the type of substantial harm, an extreme risk of substantial harm that courts tend to punish with exemplary damages. The plaintiff's failure to put on any affirmative evidence of Kroeber's state of mind is fatal to her case. In addition, the court raised in the Dillard case the suggestion that perhaps using this gross negligence definition of malice contained in the prior statute that's at issue here isn't appropriate in an intentional tort case such as this. In the Texas beef cattle case, this court held that there's a higher level of proof necessary to prove malice in intentional tortious interference with a contract case. We submit the same should be true here. When you look at the public policies underlying the tort and the reasons for the presumption and that we are trying to encourage people to report suspicious activity, you need to require...
Well, we're trying to encourage some people to report some suspicious activity. We don't want to encourage divorced spouses to report crimes by their other spouses because they do plenty of that already.
That is true.
And so, but your rule of requiring corroboration means that's going to be just fine for them to do that because there's no harm in doing that. There's no harm in lying about what your ex-spouse did because unless they corroborate it, there's no malicious prosecution.
I don't think that's necessarily true.
So really your argument depends on what kind of crimes we're wanting to encourage people to report because we want to report some and not others.
I think it has to be applied across the board. And the point that
I think probably so too, but then why shouldn't it apply this way rather than that? We've got some we do and some we don't.
No, it should
why
be.
Why should we go out on a limb with Alabama rather than stay with the other 48 states?
Well, the other states have not rejected this theory. It simply has not been brought up. The states that have analyzed this issue have ruled in favor of requiring corroboration. With respect to the spousal issue, I suspect that the evidence in such a case would show that there is no corroboration. Given how well they know each other and the availability of proof, there would likely be corroboration. Finally, I'd like to point out that the Diller case is distinguishable as far as relying on credibility of the witnesses, because that case was merely a false imprisonment case. It didn't involve the same public policy concerns behind the malicious prosecution case. With that, I'm out of time, and thank the court.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and the court will take